Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Seb Stafford-Bloor from Football 365, and Daniel Storey, the author and columnist. It was football, but not quite as we know it. The sensations were different. The sounds were strangely satisfying. The game remained the same, and that's the main thing, isn't it? The Bundesliga has set a high bar for the Premier League. It's likely there'll be a return to training this week. We'll be talking to Norwich captain Grant Hanley and Leicester's Hamza Chowdhury about that and much else later in the podcast. But let's begin with the impressions and lessons of the weekend. How was it for you, Seb?
Slightly strange, but I actually enjoyed it, Mike. I might get slaughtered for this, but I just love having it back. It's obviously, without crowds and without fans, it's a very different sport. But then I fell in love with the sport first, the actual mechanics of the game. I'm a fan of football, and I was actually pleasantly surprised by the quality of play. Because the game in Germany has been on hiatus since the middle of March, and they haven't really had a pre-season in the normal sense with competitive friendlies and long sort of conditioning programs. I was actually pleasantly surprised by the fluency and the caliber of some of the moves and the quality of some of the goals. It is odd, but I went into it with the mindset that I'm determined to enjoy it because this is going to be the new normal for quite a long time. That isn't to disregard the obvious issues that there are and the sort of the oddity of hearing players call to each other and hear sort of coaches from the technical area or to hear the extra loud clunk from goal nets. But I think this is what we're going to have to get used to. And so I think we're presented with a fairly stark choice. Either accept it and leave some of these grievances at the door, or don't watch at all. And I would always want to watch, I'd always want the game under any circumstances. So I was optimistic, with caveats.
Yeah, it was a bit like, watching a game with the mute button on, wasn't it? I just thought it was quite interesting that almost because you maybe concentrate a little bit harder, you get a greater appreciation of maybe the skill involved or the movement. That first Dortmund goal was wonderful in the fluency of it. And perhaps maybe some of the subtleties of that move would have been missed in the great hubbub of a big derby. What did you think about it, Dan?
I think it was strange. I think it was very different. I think it hammered home to me that we're going to be without supporters for a long, long time. We keep hearing this phrase, new normal. And this is going to be football's new normal. And we're going to have to get used to that. I understand the view of some that, without fans, football is nothing. And I think in a normal context, that's probably true. But at the moment, we don't have a choice. This is not going to be a sport of ideals for a long, long time. It's going to be a sport of compromise. And one of the compromises is that we're going to have to get used to this. It did feel strange, but we have to remember it was the first weekend of this new normal, and therefore it was always likely to feel very different. I think maybe in a month's time, when other leagues are doing the same, we might well get used to it a little bit more.
Yeah, I suppose, we could make it less sterile. I'm thinking about maybe putting huge flags out, maybe shirts on seats. I know that was done yesterday. I thought it was quite interesting. That was at the Cologne Mainz game, where they talked about a ghost choreo made up of shirts and scarves lent by the fans to the club. People are searching for ideas. Now, I hate the idea of piping in fan noise. I just hate it. I just think it would be so artificial. But there was one really interesting one floated by Phil Kitromidis, who he basically said, look, let's get the clubs to nominate one fan per match to watch each game. Now, obviously, there are all sorts of practical things. It could be a bit maudlin. But is that something? Has he got something there, do you think, Seb?
He does. He does. I mean, good luck trying to find that one fan to watch Mourinho's Tottenham. but yeah, I think it could be quite fun. I mean, it depends.
It'll be his son, by the way.
I think it depends on how you build around the idea. So what are you doing with that fan? So you're going to take lots of pictures of him and show him on camera a lot during the games. Are you going to mic him up during the games as well? Are you going to ask him what he thinks in the television coverage afterwards? We've covered this before, Mike. I think there's a line here. You've got to be really careful with anything artificial that you put into the stadium, because at a certain point, beyond the tipping point, the more you're trying to make it look, seem and feel like normal, the more people are actually going to miss it. So over the weekend, I caught the end of a South Korean game in the K-League, which alongside being commentated on by someone from Yorkshire and with piped in crowd noise. I mean, the whole thing was a really strange spectacle. And even these things which are designed to comfort you, so the piped in noise and the sort of the monotone sound of fans in a stadium, not rising or falling or getting more excited or more, you know, anxious. It was just a noise. Now, these things, they kind of almost add to the oddity of everything. And so you do have to be careful. But a fan would be fun. I think it depends who it is, though, doesn't it? Really? Because if you got the wrong fan, that's not going to go well, I don't think.
One of the interesting things on this piped in noise idea, which I agree with you, Mike, in terms of in the stadium, but I wonder if maybe that's something that broadcasters could do off their own back, because, you know, it's a very different experience anyway, watching a game at the ground as opposed to on television. But with things like the Bundesliga and now, let's face it, the Premier League moving forward indefinitely, we're not going to be at ground, so therefore it's going to become a purely TV spectacle. I wonder if maybe that's something that you wouldn't have it piped in the ground, but you could have kind of overlaid by broadcasters to make that televisual experience feel a little bit more normal. It's one of those things that I wouldn't know until I saw it, but I think that might be worth considering in terms of making that armchair experience feel a little bit more authentic, perhaps.
Yeah, you know, well, I think they're trying, or they're talking about something similar in baseball in the States to do with that. And actually, to be honest, I don't know about you guys, but I actually almost appreciated the commentators even more at the weekend. You know, Ian Dark, I think it was, said on social media that Paul Dempsey was commentating on the Dortmund-Schalke game. And he basically had the guy from Tesco with his online delivery of groceries knocking on his front door. And so he was thinking, do I go and get my, you know, my strawberries, or do I go and keep commentating on this? So, yeah, it was a strange old time, really. I suppose, you know, and you touched on it there, Dan, the success or the perceived success of the Bundesliga coming back will increase the pressure on the Premier League to do so, won't it?
Yeah, it will. And I mean, I think the Premier League doesn't need any added pressure, but it's certainly going to get some. Germany was always going to be the blueprint for the rest of Europe. And we have to say that part of the success was the match day, which went pretty well, and I'm glad it did. The other success that they rely upon is this week, which is the testing programme post-matches, because if there is now a spate of positive tests, then serious questions will understandably be asked. But in terms of the match day experience, I think it, as you said at the start, it set a very high bar. I don't think that any league can beat that. Everything seemed to go well. The face mask, although weird to look at, was completely understandable. The goal celebrations, these kind of socially distanced goal celebrations, created an image which I think are going to become kind of iconic for the next year of the game. But yeah, football always had to set an example that it could do this and do this with a minimum of fuss. And I think the Bundesliga did that. And the Premier League will, I think, be very happy that someone else made the first move, but also be happy that they do have that blueprint to follow.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, we're all beginning to sift through the weekend. One thing I think will probably be significant is the fact that there were, I think it was 8 muscle injuries in the 6 Bundesliga matches that were played. That then gets to the heart of the physical demands on players. You know, obviously there will be an urge to rush back as soon as possible. You know, there's some talk about a training return this week, and then also games, well, pick a date at the moment, you know, June the 12th, June the 19th, you know, the more cautious people are saying June the 26th now. That's going to be a key decision, isn't it? Can we get players, you know, maybe not performing at optimum levels right at the start, but can we protect them from getting these injuries? What do you think, Seb?
Yeah, I think so, Mike. I think it's also about what kind of concessions we make after that start date. So, I mean, when the Premier League resumes is going to be dictated by, yes, how the Bundesliga performs, what kind of testing, what the testing reveals this week, but also when it wants to finish, because this is a race against time. This is a move of convenience. So I wonder, you know, is it smart potentially to play more games in the evening? Because obviously we're going to be playing through the summer. So we can't do that much about the stress being placed on players' muscles, apart from adding an extra two substitutions into the legislation temporarily. But can we make it cooler? What can we do around the games and the conditions around the games to aid recovery times? I'm not really smart enough to answer that question. I don't have the requisite knowledge. But yeah, this is going to be an issue, because we could have a situation where, don't forget, whilst these players have been in lockdown, they haven't lived exactly like us three. I mean, in the sense that they're not ordering off delivery every night and, you know, putting on 5 kilos. But even for a professional athlete, trying to maintain some semblance of, you know, elite condition, it's going to be absolutely impossible. So it's not like a pre-season where you come straight in and you've been building up in warm weather and you're going to get a few muscle tweaks in August and September anyway. We could have a spate of injuries throughout the first few weeks of this, and it could almost to the extent where it could compromise the integrity of the competition itself. So these are very serious considerations. They won't be prioritized because there are bigger questions to answer, but this is certainly an issue which is going to need to be addressed as we actually get going.
Yeah, I think the clubs have got to understand that this is going to be an acutely personal decision for players and coaches and managers, isn't it? What I also find very interesting in the sort of build-up to these decisions is that the way certain clubs are emerging as, you know, perhaps not consciously, but spokespeople for their trade. You know, Brighton have been, you know, been on the front foot in PR terms. I find Watford's stance really quite interesting. You've got Troy Deeney, who was very direct, which is pretty unsurprising since he was entirely in character. Nigel Pearson obviously was raising doubts as well. I also think, in a broader sense here, Dan, you know, Watford, for instance, have given over their ground to NHS employees from the adjoining hospital. Do you think almost a new sort of social contract is starting to emerge here?
I hope so. I really do. And I hope it's a lasting one that leaves a legacy beyond this pretty miserable period in everyone's lives. So I think, you know, I think Troy's argument, and he does it deliberately and I think rightly, is to try and undermine this kind of festering argument that players are highly paid prima donnas that don't really want to go back to work. That seems to be incredibly unfair. This is a point of personal and familial protection. They understand that if anything goes wrong, then it has far-reaching consequences that extend way beyond football, you know, into players' lives. We've long treated players to greater and lesser extents as either robots or performing circus animals, but we cannot ignore the connection between players' professional lives and their personal lives and the lives of their families and loved ones. And I think it's wholly appropriate that they make the point that, hang on a minute, we're not just going to be rushed back because the Premier League wants its entertainment product and supporters want to watch football again. This goes beyond that. You know, we need to remember where football sits in the greater social construct, and we need to see, you know, in it, where football sits in footballers' everyday lives. And whilst I know they love the game, and I'm sure most of them would love to be back playing, there are other considerations now, and quite frankly, there are other priorities.
Yeah, but the pressure won't decrease, will it? You know, when you look at it, Seb, you've got, you know, the perceived wisdom from UEFA is that the Champions League final really has to be played on August the 29th. You know, that's by its very nature an artificial target. But I suppose it just adds to this groundswell of pressure. Look, you've got to get this on.
Yeah, I've never agreed with that UEFA deadline, really, Mike, because I've never seen the purpose behind it. I mean, I know you've got to get the competition finished, but it's the wrong way around. If you want to have a position which genuinely is supportive of the, you know, the long-term future of the clubs, then domestic competition is much more important because, without question, it affects far more of the game's general population. I find it unhelpful, like you say, because it is another pressure, and also it's another thing that can be used to obfuscate the very real human issues that lie at the heart of this. It feels wrong. Feels wrong to me.
Yeah. And, you know, as we're speaking, you know, players are talking and players are wondering, you know, when on earth they're going to actually get into a training ground. You know, if you look at the primary guidelines, talking about, you know, players working on their own, turning up in their cars already changed, probably be around at the training ground for as little as, you know, just over an hour, 75 minutes, something like that. We've been talking this week to a couple of players who are going through that process at different stages of their career, really, and they have interesting perspectives. We've talked to Hamza Chowdhury at Leicester, but first off, here's the conversation Seb and I had with Grant Hanley, senior pro club captain at Norwich, and someone who is a key conduit for all the information that his teammates need.
Grant, thanks for coming in, mate. I'd just really like to start looking at your role as captain, how it's evolved. My son worked at the club for a couple of seasons. Stu brought him in with the recruitment team, so he's obviously seen the way you work as a captain. Can we just start off, how has your role of captain evolved during recent weeks? Are you sort of consciously communicating more widely and more often with your teammates and coaches and the club itself?
No, definitely, I think so. You know, obviously, something like this is, you know, I've never been through as a captain before. It's sort of, you've kind of got to be that middleman. Obviously, I speak to the club, I speak to Stuart, you know, very regularly. So, in terms of being that middleman and, you know, going back and feeding back information to the players, that's sort of been my job. And I think it's important, you know, obviously, as a captain, I've got to try and do the best for the players and hear the players and know what their opinions are. So, I think that's been very important, you know, keeping constant contact with the lads and, you know, see what their feelings are. And, you know, it's been constant questions and what's happening here, what's happening then, what does that mean, what's this? So, you know, it's been difficult because, you know, as you know, we've not always got the answers, but I think it's important to, you know, try and do your best to, you know, at least help the lads as much as you can.
Yeah, you were also captain at Blackburn, of course. You know, what is it about the role that suits your character and experience? I suppose, you know, you acquire a certain sense of perspective, don't you, in these circumstances?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure. I mean, I've always been a talker in terms of on the pitch. You know, that's one of the biggest parts of my games, I think, in terms of organising and, you know, sort of doing a bit in terms of that. I think that's probably, you know, one of my strong points. But, you know, I like to think as myself as well as sort of level-headed and, you know, try to always do the right thing and sort of set an example.
Grant, can I just ask, I mean, you're obviously a senior member of the dressing room. Is your role accentuated with the younger people? Because obviously you've got some guys at the club who, within this lockdown situation, some of them might be living by themselves for the first time. Some of them might be going through what's a difficult situation for everybody without the support of friends and family. Has it been kind of your role as captain to, I suppose for a better choice of phrase, to look after them?
No, I think so. I think, but, you know, lads are, you know, I think we've got a good group of lads in terms of they're all sensible young men and, you know, they know what's right and wrong. And I think they can look after themselves to a certain extent. But like you said, we've got a young dressing room, so there's a lot of young lads there. So it's important that we, you know, we're all keeping in touch and we all, you know, do our best to help each other and keep in contact. You know, but like I said, I think that the most important thing there is, you know, we have got a good dressing room. There's no sort of bad eggs, if you like. And, you know, the lads know that they need to, you know, mentally and physically stay ready and be professional.
You've been a first team pro for what, a decade, just over a decade. Is this as much a mental challenge as a physical one, you know, preparing yourself to come back, you know, whenever that might be?
No, definitely. I mean, it's been tough. It's been tough on everyone, the whole country, the whole world, really. Mentally, it's been tough, you know, it's something that we've never been through before. You know, I don't think any of us have been in this sort of situation where, that's it, you've maybe got an hour a day to do a bit of exercise. But no, certainly it, you know, it has been a mental challenge. But I think obviously physically as well. You know, we've got to remember our jobs at the end of the day. We're professional footballers, so I think we need to be ready both physically and mentally for when the time comes that, you know, we do go back.
From a more sort of football place, how do the young players at clubs, so someone like a group like Max Ahrens and Todd Cantwell, Jamal Lewis, how do they compare as a group of young players to what you've experienced previously?
In terms of having that many, you know, young lads that are got so much potential and so much talent in one squad, you know, I think that's probably very rare to find. There's just so many of them. You know, think of Ben, think of Jamal, think of Max, think of Todd, think of Emmy. You know, I hope I've not missed any of them there, but you know, there's certainly a good group of them that have got, you know, the potential and the talent to, I believe, go all the way to the top. But I think the biggest compliment I can probably give them is their temperament is second to none. And it's, you know, for me, seeing young lads that are getting thrown in the deep end, if you like, handle themselves in such a way where they're always so calm, they're always so professional, and they just deal with everything that's put in front of them. You know, that's the biggest compliment I can probably give them.
Is that one of the biggest challenges with promotion, when you've got, like, being a young player in the Championship to going to, you know, all of a sudden you're a young player who's on Match of the Day every Saturday, like for someone like Todd Cantwell, he's scoring goals against Manchester City, and all of a sudden, is temperament the key ingredient there to a player being able to deal with that adjustment, you know, particularly when they're talented and young?
No, definitely. I think so. Like I said, I'm thankful to the club for putting that trust in them and giving them that opportunity. But, you know, to see them take it in their stride and, you know, progress so well and do so well and perform so well, you know, fair play to them, because it's, you don't get that often. You don't see young lads that come into a team and stay in a team for a sustained period of time and continue to perform at the top level.
What are the biggest differences, do you think, in terms of defending and attacking, obviously, between the Championship and the Premier League? Is it simply you're punished more readily for your mistakes?
No, I think so. Obviously, the quality of player is obviously better in the Premier League. The physical aspect of it has been a jump up for us as well, in terms of, you know, everyone's an athlete. Everybody's got a physical attribute that is, you know, a massive threat. And also, like you said, when they do get that chance, more often than not, it's a goal. So it's, you know, it's been a big part of our season, just, you know, try to find that level of consistency where, you know, you try and limit opportunities to the opponents as much as you can.
I looked it up this morning, and I think you're one of eight players who's still at the club from 2017. So that's a kind of period of 3 years. What have been the main differences in the club that you found when you first arrived and the one that exists around you now?
Tough one to answer, because 2017 I signed, but
yeah,
obviously it was a new club for me at that time as well. So I was walking into something that was strange to me anyway. So as it was changing, I'm kind of just going through the motions with that anyway. It is a tough one to answer. Obviously, there's a lot of new faces. I'd say it's probably a lot younger dressing room now than what it was when I first walked in. But no, I think it's, overall, I would say it's, you know, it's a good place to be. I think as soon as I walked in the door, I got the feeling of the atmosphere and sort of the culture around the place that, you know, Stuart's kind of drove forward since I've been here, in terms of being, you know, in it together and sort of family orientated. You know, I think that's a massive part of the club, and it's a massive part of playing here.
As a player, as a senior player, is it a different experience working as a head coach stroke manager?
It is. I mean, in terms of the football side, obviously, you know, the manager is sort of totally in charge there. But in terms of having a sporting director, it's, you know, something I've never done before. And I've never sort of worked as closely with someone, if you know what I mean. Mm. You know, I think Stuart would probably tell you the same. You know, we've got a really good relationship. You know, especially throughout what's been going on recently, you know, we've been in constant contact. But even so, on a day-to-day basis, you know, he's constantly at the training ground, so you've sort of got that relationship already because you're seeing him every day.
With Daniel Farker, he refused to change Norwich's style. You know, the temptation obviously was maybe to tighten up and make it more defensive in strategy. How did the squad or the group feel about that as a collective?
You know, I think fair play to the manager, because, you know, he's got his beliefs and he's got his philosophy, and, you know, that's what we stick by. And because we've had success doing it that way, you know, the players buy into that. And, you know, we understand and we appreciate that if we want to be successful, this is the way we've got to do it.
And as a final point, what do you think will be the key factors in Norwich staying up if and when the season resumes?
No, I think, you know, it's not just my opinion. I think probably generally as a whole, people would probably say that Norwich have performed well in the league. You know, as players, you know, believe that we've, you know, performance-wise, we've done well, and we've always, there's only been, you know, maybe three or four games that I can remember where we've not really competed. Most games we're competing and we're getting beat by the odd goal. So I think, obviously, it's just finding that little extra couple of percent of that little bit of edge that, you know, gets you a draw instead of getting beat, or gets you a win instead of getting a draw, you know, to get some points over the line. But, you know, what I will say is, it's in terms of being in a relegation battle, it's the atmosphere around the club doesn't feel what you'd expect it to feel like. Still feels like there's that feel-good factor, and, you know, we've still got the fans behind us, the dressing room's still a good place to be. You know, we've definitely created the right atmosphere and, you know, the right working environment to be able to achieve what we want. And it's, you know, that's just up to the players to get it right on the pitch and get the points that we need.
That's great. Thank you very much, Grant. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Cheers, guys.
The voice of experience there, Dan. With Grant Hanley, someone like him, he was almost defined by his sense of authority. When he was at Blackburn, he was club captain. He's done the same role at Norwich. And I know that Stu Webber, the sporting director, really places great store by his character. In general terms, can you spot the leader in football?
I think you can anyway, and I think you can much more easily at a time like this. I think as football supporters, we're used to that vision of a captain being, you know, the kind of chest-beating, crowd-motivating leader. But actually, it goes far, far beyond that remit. And every footballer you speak to will say exactly the same. A captain isn't judged generally by what they do on the pitch, although that clearly sometimes happens in crucial moments of crucial seasons. But they're judged by how they raise everyone and treat everyone around them. And at a time like this, that has never been more important. I would suggest that nothing that Grant Hanley does now, and any club captain in the Premier League does between now and the end of whenever the season finishes, will be as important as the work they've done in the last month, which is keeping contact with players, helping younger players, you know, just offering a voice, offering a, you know, an ear to players who need some moral and emotional support. And that work is very easy to overlook and almost impossible to measure, but do not be tricked into thinking that clubs don't appreciate it.
Yeah, what struck me about him was his level-headedness. It's interesting talking to people at the club, Seb, that they actually felt the benefit of him more in the promotion season, where he was injured early, couldn't get back into the team, and yet responded as almost like a rallying point in the dressing room. I also thought it was very interesting, I don't know what you feel, that he said, look, this doesn't feel like a relegation dressing room. The dressing room, can you read that dressing room and can you rely on it?
I don't know. I mean, it's for an outsider, it's a really hard question to answer. It's also, are we listening to a captain saying the things that he should be saying in that situation? Is he leading by what he believes the example should be? I don't know. But what I will say, Mike, is, and I know this is an unusual situation in the world and it's unprecedented, but I think this relates to relegation. After we spoke to Grant, I remember thinking, if I was a young player in that dressing room and I had an issue, maybe it's coronavirus related, maybe it's a life problem, you're stuck in your home and you're unsure about, what you should be doing fitness wise. I remember thinking, now, would I be more comfortable talking to my captain in this situation or my manager? And I thought, well, what a luxury it would be to have someone like that as my captain. You know, someone that you could phone up and say, look, this is going on and I need your help. And it's kind of, a secondary answer to the question you posted, Dan, in that I think that's the value of captaincy. At the moment, it's accentuated by what's going on in the world, but apply this to relegation. So a young player who's suffering with his form, who doesn't want to admit to having doubts or concerns to a manager because of how he may be judged, you go to your captain. I think that's where leadership is really, really relevant at the moment.
Yeah, and someone who's benefiting from leadership, probably more from his coach in this circumstance, is Hamza Chowdhury. England under 21 international, obviously in competition with Wolf and Didi at Leicester, but part of a generation of players there who have the potential to It seems a very strange phrase I'm about to use, but you know, restore former glories. Well, it's only a few years since they won the Premier League, so I suppose that you can get away with that. I found him really engaging, very intelligent and very convincing. You make up your own mind now.
Thanks for joining us, Hamza, on the Football Writers Podcast. We're all in a very strange situation. Footballers are basically in isolation, training on their own. Obviously, it's really different. How different is it?
It's been crazy, really. I feel like it's been a completely new situation, but I feel like for us, it's been different because normally we're told to be somewhere at a certain time and this is what you're going to do and this is exactly what you're going to do. So to sort of drag yourself out of bed in the morning and have to motivate yourself, it's been difficult because it's so new. I feel like the gaffer and the club and the sports science at Leicester have been really good and made it really easy and set out different exercises to do. So they've kept us on our toes and kept us fit.
Yeah. What are you doing sort of aerobically?
Aerobically, I've got a treadmill and there's quite a few fields near my house. I've got runs set out for me to do. So they sent out as a little box full of cones, power bags, et cetera, stuff like that. So it's just been really easy for us to set out.
How quickly do things like technique subside? So like when you come back to training properly, what's the drop off for you? Like not having that kind of regular ball work with teammates, what's that like?
It's difficult because obviously we were really in at the back end of the season. I think we had 9 games to go. So it all becomes so natural to you because you're working it every day for the last 6-7 months. So it will be tricky, I feel like, when we go back. But within them drills and exercises they do, they give us little bits of ball work to do. I know it's difficult and it's never going to be the same or easy to keep it competitive. But it's just to try and keep your feet on the ball, get as many touches as you can. So it's not alien to us when we go back.
What sort of things are you missing? You know, is it just the sort of the competitive edge, the adrenaline rush of a match? Or what's the specific things that you miss?
I feel like it's the camaraderie. It's the banter that the boys having in around the training ground. It's crazy, really. And especially in our dressing room, we're a real close-knit group and we actually get along and do stuff outside of football together. So in that way, it's been really difficult. But we've been trying to communicate as much as we can over WhatsApp and text messages and whatnot. But yeah, I've really missed that.
Yeah, because that does define your group, isn't it? You know, you're all of a similar age. You know, you're, what, 22? You've got 7 or 8 guys around your age group together. How does that help you personally? Is it almost like a sort of band of brothers thing going on?
Yeah, for sure. If you ask any of us that, we're all close. But it's not only the ones that are younger. I feel like the older boys, the likes of Casper, Wes, Johnny, the older heads, are just as close, really. Go and speak to them about whatever and anything at whatever time, to be honest. But we've got a really really, really good group. But the boys, the younger, we've got like really, really similar interests. So like you say, it's so easy to go into football. It's something that you wake up and sort of look forward to. And I can't really say anything else apart from that.
Us in the media, sometimes we talk about when you've got like a young clutch of talent like you do at Leicester, we talk about kind of that almost as a homogenous group. I know you've spoken there about what it's like socially, but when you experience things for the first time within a season as a group, is it helpful to have each other around? So you have a bad defeat or you've had a good win. Do you feel yourself growing as a group when those kind of things happen?
Yeah, for sure. For many of us, like you say, because we're so young, it's new experiences. So you don't really know how to react. So it's so important and so helpful. Like I say, like Bard, Johnny, Wes, Casper, they talk to you through the situation, especially the manager. So for them to tell us that it's okay to lose games and okay to react and get emotional, or it's not. In some instances, that's not the way to react. I feel like that's really important for us and for us to take in our careers.
Is that stuff like when you make steps in the game, like where you play for, you went to the under-21s last summer, and is that the same? Like you have people to kind of to lean on to find out what making those little journeys is going to be like for you. Is that kind of another useful bit of it?
Yeah, for sure. I feel like if you speak to anyone that plays sports, they've got that mentor or a few people that they can go back and relate to and just really just to let go, let loose and tell them how you're feeling, because it's new experiences and it can either really beat you or make you. So in that sort of aspect, it's really good to have them people around.
Yeah. Can I take you back to the first day that you walked into the training ground? You know, you're 7 years old. You must be looking around and thinking, wow, what is this place? If you had any advice now to offer that 7-year-old who walked in for the first time, what would it be?
Enjoy it. the atmosphere at Leicester and what we've got at the club is really special. And a lot of the boys come through not feeling the pressure as such as the likes of Man City and Chelsea and the big clubs. And at a young age, just to enjoy it, really. And to be honest, that's a lot with my family. They didn't really put pressure on my shoulders. It was more of me enjoying it and letting off some steam in the early days. But obviously, later on, it gets more competitive and they really keep you grounded and make you work hard.
What's it like working with Brendan Rodgers as a coach? What do you think he's added to your game?
A lot, to be honest. He's brought in so much stuff that I almost knew I needed to work on, but he's helped me work on it specific to my game and game understanding and game management. He sits down with me in his office and takes me through clips and analysis and stuff like that. And he's got really good backroom staff, the likes of Chris Colo and Sads, that take out the day. And we do extra sessions the majority of the days after 5 minutes. That's all it takes, really. But you see yourself building in games and you see pictures and images that you didn't really notice before.
The first time I saw you play, Hamza, I think it was, I think you played almost like as a fullback. I think I've seen you play in central defence, in holding midfield and slightly further forward. What's your favourite position to play?
Before this manager came in, I would have definitely said as a holding midfielder, but I enjoyed maybe playing as a number eight. But I don't know. It's a difficult question, really. Maybe an eight or a six. Depends on the system we're playing and who we're playing against. But no, it's difficult to say.
What have you learned in competition with Wolf and Didi?
You have to put it in every day. Wolf, relentless. Honestly, every day it's just again and again and again. And I feel like that's what you have to be to get to the top level. And that's sort of what the manager's trying to drill into us as young boys, is that it's not one day that you take your foot off the pedal. You've got to work as hard as you did the last day, if not harder.
Is that definition of professionalism, though?
For sure. For sure. Yeah, there's, like I say, there's loads of the older boys and they never let the standards slip. So competitive, and it makes training interesting. It gets feisty at times, but I feel like that's what you want. Especially as a manager, you want to have players in certain positions that give you problems that you don't, the choices that you don't really want to make. So no, it's a really good environment for young boys to be coming through.
Is it helpful for you, for someone like Wilf Ndidi, like, okay, he's probably not as widely acclaimed as he probably should be, but is it really helpful to have someone in a similar position to you who's setting such a high standard? Does that give you, not just in terms of like how you apply yourself in training, but in terms of the level of performance, is it just useful to have that as a barometer?
Yeah, for sure. Training and playing with him is something that you need to take into account, and you need to watch him and take in specifics and learn from him. And also, because he's competition, learn from his mistakes and see where I can improve and where he's maybe not so good at and vice versa. But no, to see him, I feel like we've watched him for the last two, three years, especially being at Leicester. So we always knew how good he was and what his attributes were. So I feel like because we've done so well as a team, maybe the media and other sources have maybe concentrated on him a little bit more this season.
How good do you think you can be as a team? What are the limits, the realistic limits of your ambitions, do you think?
I don't really feel like there is a limit to what we can do. I feel like this is the manager's first season. We've got a very young team and we were so disappointed when we didn't let it slip, but we slipped off a little bit and the gap between us and Man City and Liverpool grew. I feel like it's such a learning curve for us and it's better that it's happened now in his first season. But the infrastructure at our club and the owner, going down from the owner to the managers to the players, the staff really are so amazing that I don't feel like there's a limit to what we can do.
Was there a message from Brendan after those games? I remember covering the defeat at the Etihad. It was almost as if like you're an excellent side and it was just a little bit disappointing given what you were capable of. What did he say to you guys during that period to kind of to keep your trajectory in the right position?
He was just brutally honest with us at times in that, okay, we're not at that level yet, but that's where we want to be. And to see him play against it is something that you want to experience. But he said, we're not at that level, but we will be, to work hard and training. And it's okay that we've lost, but we need to bounce back better. And next time we play them or next season that comes around, we're going to be ready for them. And they're not going to beat us or dominate the game like that. So.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for your time, Hamza. There's just one last question. It's a daft one, which is probably our speciality. I talk a lot to players who are undergoing long-term rehab. And a lot of them say, yeah, I actually dream about playing football because I'm away from it. You know, I see the guys in the training ground and everything else. Because you haven't played football for, a couple of months, are you dreaming about football now?
I wouldn't say regularly. I think, to be honest, I don't really remember any of my dreams, to be honest.
Be careful, Hamza. Don't answer this too specifically.
Yeah, no, I don't know. No.
All right, mate. I told you it was a daft one. Anyway, well, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Hamza.
So, Seb, I said before then I was really impressed with him. What was your view of him?
I thought he was a delight. I think it was really interesting. You, after we finished recording, Mike, we had a little conversation about it. And it was just, I found him to be, you know, indicative of the sort of the modern generation of footballer who has thoughts about the game and is expressive and is just engaging. And I know things are a little bit strange over Zoom and it's not quite the same as interviewing a player in real life. But I found him really interesting. And I don't know whether you guys would agree with this, but I found that I think as a footballer, Hamza Chowdhury is a technically very gifted player, but also really thoughtful with his passing and seems to, even for his level of experience, seems to read the game really well. And I felt like that reflected a little bit in his personality. Now, that might be me drawing lines that don't exist, but that's the impression I got. It's kind of, can you draw a parallel between the way a player speaks and responds to questions versus what they are on the pitch and what role it is they're there to perform? It was interesting.
Yeah. I get the sense, Dan, that Leicester will continue to improve. You know, obviously, they're one of the surprises of the season as it stands. That idea of a group of players moving together, you know, is very much against modern business principles in many ways because people do move on from clubs like Leicester. But you've got 6, 7, 8 players around about that sort of 22 to 24 age group. How important is that?
Yeah, it's absolutely huge. And it's gold dust, quite frankly, in a game that, as you say, has become incredibly transient in terms of player and manager moves. They've got something that you can't recreate. And quite frankly, you wouldn't want to recreate at Leicester, in that they've got this memory of their former owner, who they are absolutely determined to, you know, to show the best of and to make him proud without resorting to sort of twee cliche. They very much do believe that. They believe that everything they do now is to say thank you for what their former owner allowed them to achieve, and they will do everything they can to do it. And that's a very powerful mantra to set out to young players, to say, hang on a minute, you're not here just to earn a big move to a big club. You're not even here just to win a trophy. You're here because we are all committed to this pursuit of the memory of Vichai. And yeah, I think they've got the perfect manager to do that. I think they've got a manager who, while he has an ego, and that's important for players and managers, you need that, is also absolutely committed again to making clubs the best he can be and making the style of play the best he can be that he believes in, and making every player pursue that goal wholeheartedly. And, you know, it's very odd in that we've got this dichotomy between the Premier League, in which the very richest have this huge leg up, and yet clubs like Leicester, who sit below that financial elite, can bridge the gap by doing things smartly, doing things cleverly, and still having the financial resources to buy and recruit effectively.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, the importance of management there, Dan. We have this existing feature where we ask listeners to suggest their own football heroes. Now, obviously, 99.9% of them are players. But there was one which caught my eye from Nason Nero. He suggested that Herbert Chapman should be our hero in terms of, you know, as he says, the man was a visionary, a pioneer, an innovator. The ideas he had and the ones he implemented revolutionised the game forever in this country. He was a pioneer of modern tactics, numbered shirts, floodlights, pitch marking. His intelligence was decades ahead of his time. Seb, we live in an age, don't we, where the manager is a bit of a matador, really, a media matador. Do we actually underestimate what came before the modern generation, do you think? Some of those legendary managers who were around when we weren't around.
In Chapman's case, without question, Mike, because he's a little bit of an outlier. He died very early. He's been dead for nearly 90 years now, but in his career essentially lies the sort of the basis for the modern game. All the things you've mentioned, the floodlights, the numbered shirts, the modern tactics. There are interesting other little bits too. Like Chapman almost believed in kind of dressing room democracy. So he wanted players to have ownership of what they were doing on the pitch, which is a really, really modern idea. In this country, he was certainly the first manager to popularise the WM formation. He was the first to use tactics boards in the dressing room. You know, he basically built a lot of the cliches that exist around the game. For people who are interested, he has a comparison in American sports with Paul Brown, the former head coach of the Cleveland Browns, in the sense that he was a man of innovation. And there's some fabulous documentaries on YouTube about Paul Brown. He invented sort of radios in quarterbacks' helmets and stuff like that. And it's really interesting. And Chapman is that guy in English football, but many, many years before, decades before, which really depicts his level of innovation. I think he's a fascinating character. Anyone who's at a loss during lockdown still, I recommend the biography of his life. It's a fascinating read.
Yeah, it's a good book. Very good book. Yeah. Dan, in terms of, you know, the managers that you've experienced, both, you know, maybe as a fan, but also as a journalist, which manager left the most abiding impression on you?
There are two that kind of stick out for different reasons. The first is, you know, I was lucky enough to spend a fair amount of time with Eddie Howe and at Bournemouth. And, you know, he's a manager who is not without the pressures of, you know, of modern football in terms of impatience and in terms of the financial penalties of relegation. And Bournemouth are clearly haunted by that at the moment. But he is an incredibly focused man. And, you know, we talked about Chapman as this kind of almost the first manager to wrestle control away from directors and want to do everything himself. That is Eddie Howe. You know, he is someone who wants to, if he believes that changing the breakfast cereal will give his team a 0.1% better chance of winning the next game, he will do that. He is absolutely obsessed. And the other one more recently I met was Danny Cowley, who is just incredibly intense, is absolutely obsessed and addicted to winning, or at least trying to win it in any way possible. Is, again, you, when you meet these managers, you realise, again, we said it about captains, that you see what they do on the pitch. The same is true with managers. You think, well, he's not very good at making substitutions, or he doesn't shout at his players much on the touchline. But you get some insight into just how much these people dedicate themselves to their craft, and just how much it becomes all-consuming in, you know, not just their professional lives, but pretty much every waking minute of every day.
Yeah, well, I can remember with Eddie Howe, I went to interview him for my manager's book, Living on the Volcano, and got to the stadium at 6:25 in the morning, and he'd beaten me to it. And you know, I went to see, he was going through a game when I popped up to his office about 6:40, something ridiculous. And equally, Danny and his brother as well. You know, I spent quite a bit of time with them when they were at Lincoln, and there's a lovely sort of, and this is not disrespectful, there's a Sunday League flavour to them as well, where, you know, you go into the manager's office, it does whiff a bit because there's sweaty kit in the corner, there's really muddy Adidas gels all over the floor, the coach is making tea and toast. It's brilliant, you know, and that to me is, you know, that smell, actually, funny enough, of rancid kit is actually one of the smells of football, isn't it? So there's an authenticity to it, I suppose, you know?
Yeah.
Talking of authenticity, you know, we've got this series, which is, you know, basically our version of Room 101. The matches that we cannot bear to watch again. I'll throw mine in right at the start. It's the 2019 FA Cup final. Manchester City 6, Watford 0. Now, that's got nothing to do with allegiance or quality. You know, I was brought up with Watford. Frankly, I'm now a distant lover, really. But Manchester City on that day, they were so good, it was almost pointless. You know, it was a wonderful hat-trick by Raheem Sterling. And to me, someone who was brought up on the grandeur of an FA Cup final, and, you know, the sense that it was the exclamation mark on a season, a game like that being reduced to an embarrassing training game, to be perfectly honest, really got to me. And I'd never, ever want to see it again. Dan, what about yourself?
Well, congratulations to you for shunning your non-partisan hat. I'm very much going to put it squarely on my own head. But yeah, I am a Nottingham Forest fan, and Nottingham Forest relationships with the playoffs is infamous. We've been in several campaigns and never got to a playoff final. But the closest we came was in 2007 when we won 2-0 in the away leg against Yeovil, and were all set to go to Wembley and transpired to lose on aggregate. We were 3-1 up on aggregate with 8 minutes to go, conceded an own goal and then a header. We had that imperfect hat trick of own goal, red card and horrific defensive mistake by Wes Morgan to send us out, who would then obviously go on and captain our rivals to the Premier League title. And I remember my abiding memory is coming out of the ground and some opportunistic local businessman had, assuming Forest would qualify, had put in under the windscreen wipers of cars in the local area, had put this coach's offer, travel to Wembley, cheap travel to Wembley. And it just, you know, it, to be honest, it made people laugh, the dark humour of it. But yeah, I never, ever want to watch that game again.
You'd like to unburden your souls, Seb?
So I'll go back to January 1999 and a cup tie between Oxford United and Chelsea. So I went to school in Oxford for a long time and I grew very attached to Oxford United because I could just walk up Headington Hill to the old manor ground, and it was in the days before my mum would let me go to North London by myself. And it was a classic underdog game. It was a very patchwork, financially blighted Oxford United somehow finding themselves in the lead, Dean Windass header at the near post in front of the old London Road end. And they played brilliantly. And then with, I think, about a minute and a half left, having already missed quite a good chance, the 8'9" Kevin Francis stuck out a telescopic leg and very clearly took the ball off Gianluca Vialli. So much so that it actually went out for a throw-in. And I think it was Mike Riley, or it might have been Mike Reid, actually, who... the referee rather than the, you know, the old landlord of the Queen Vic in EastEnders.
And the comedian.
Yeah.
It would have been appropriate, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And it's one of the worst decisions I've ever seen. And I'm a Tottenham fan, so I've left the loyalties at the door, but it was heartbreaking to watch. It was one of those where it was the kind of injustice which felt perfectly in keeping with what the game was turning into, in the kind of the conspiratorial big club gets everything. And Oxford for most of the 90s, obviously were on the edge of a precipice post Robert Maxwell and the unravelling of his finances. It was one of the cruelest things I've ever seen in football. If you can find it, I'm sure it still exists somewhere, but it's one of the worst penalty decisions I've ever seen. And Frank Leboeuf tucked it away and Chelsea went on to win the replay at Stamford Bridge.
The way of life, the way of life. Okay, well, just to pull this together now, you know, our thoughts for the day, really. Dan, is there anything you want to get off your chest?
Yeah, and it's something I've said before and probably will say at boring length again. But I think one thing we need to learn, particularly during this crisis, is that the shaming of empty seats needs to stop. We all agree that ticket prices are too high and fans are being ignored as the game kind of dances with rampant capitalism. And yet we seem to play into the hands of those who exclude those fans by kind of delighting in and mocking this triumphant crowing of empty seats. That, you know, empty seats are not a judgment on the loyalty of supporters. They're a judgment on a game that has alienated them from something they love. And if we could only remember during this crisis that there's a lot more that unites us than divides us, you know, we will be stronger going forward as a unit of football supporters.
Yeah, well said. Well said. Seb?
Yeah, I'll go back to something I touched on right at the beginning. I was really impressed by the standard of football over the weekend, and it made me think, because it made me consider all the challenges that coaches and players have been facing with social distancing, yes, but the kind of the oddity of training and sort of the lack of proper preparation. And yet they were able, over the course of the weekend, I saw three really excellent games. I gleefully watched every minute of football that was available to me, and three of them were fantastic. And it made me think about the ways in which coaches impart information, but also the way players adapt to it. Because players are always, especially in this country, players are pelted with fairly pejorative assumptions about their intelligence and about their comprehension. For people who understand sort of how many set pieces there are in open play and the amount of understanding that has to go into a cohesive team performance, I think the players and the coaching staff are due an awful lot of credit in the Bundesliga and the Bundesliga-Zwei. They were a real testament to the work that's going on in this weird sort of sterile quarantine centre.
Yeah. Well, I hope listeners will forgive me the personal note that I want to end with. Mel Johnson, who was my spiritual guide to scouting, called me last night. It was really good to hear from him since we were worried about his health. Thankfully, he was released from hospital himself on Friday. The news, though, he had to deliver cut me to the quick. John Griffin, the Scout's scout, had passed away. He was a warm, wise man who felt the game in his bones. Hundreds of footballers owe their careers to him. He sensed talent through instinct. To give you an example, he realised that Stan Collymore was a latent talent, literally, by watching him run out onto a pitch. Nothing more, nothing less. He left that game after 20 minutes because he didn't want anyone to realise what he'd seen. Now, Griff won universal trust and admiration, which is very rare in football. And his passing reminds us of football's hidden heroes. They're the scouts who wreck their cars, sometimes even wreck their marriages, for 40p a mile. Now, they've been really hard hit in this current crisis. And I hope, against hope, that they won't be forgotten, because they're really important people. Thanks to all of you for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast. And please, stay safe out there.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.